Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. A busy, busy program today. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. I said yesterday I was going to bring up this subject, but we ran out of time, and right out of the blocks, right at the start of the program, I want to ask this question because I'm curious about your answer to this question. Will you retire in Vermont, or is it too expensive to do that here in the Green Mountain State? Welcome your phone calls, but we're introducing also a new way that you can get in touch with us and voice your opinion. If you go to the WDEV Facebook page, you can vote online with this particular question. Will you retire in Vermont, or is it too expensive to do so? Right now, I can tell you that the yeses are at 33%, the noes are at 0%, and the maybes are at 67%. I can't see the vote total, but I suspect the vote total is still low because we're just sort of introducing this concept. But what I hope to do is every day have a poll question on our Facebook page that you can participate in. So it gives you different ways to express your opinion. Some people don't feel comfortable calling in, but they want to voice an opinion. Others have emailed me, and I appreciate that. But I really appreciate when you call in and give me your opinions, give me your comments, because I like that interaction. But this is another vehicle for you to discuss what we discuss here on Open Mic. It's go on to the WDEV Facebook page and vote. Will you retire in Vermont? And right now, it's yes is 33%, maybe is 67%, and no is 0%. And then after we have this discussion about whether you will retire in Vermont or is it too expensive, we'll turn to your health. And Dr. Harry Chen will join us to talk about ticks and tick-borne diseases. As you all know, it's been a mild winter, and that has raised concerns about ticks and tick bites. And we've had several guests on talking about it. We're going to get the perspective of Dr. Harry Chen, the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health. And after we check in with our colleagues at Talk Media News, and there's a lot to talk about with Talk Media News, Ann Galloway of Vermont Digger will join us to talk about the future of the news media. And the reason I asked Ann to come in is because her publication is completely digital. And we spoke yesterday with Rob Mitchell, and I really appreciate that he came on the program and talked very candidly about the decision to reduce the print edition of the Rutland Herald Times Argus to 4 days, with the other 3 days being digital, and talked about the expense that's involved in producing a printed newspaper. But does digital have challenges too? That's what I want to ask Ann. What are the challenges that digital news has? And lastly, we need a frank discussion about Donald Trump. And if you're a Donald Trump supporter out there, I can predict you're going to be upset with me. I just know you're going to be upset with me. But my reasons, I think my reasons are valid of why we need this frank discussion. So vote on our online poll by going to our WDEV Facebook page. And let's start with the concept of retirement. Will you retire in Vermont or is it too expensive to retire here? And the reason I'm asking that question is a couple of things happened in the last few weeks that have been in the newspaper. One of them is that the minimum wage, for example, in Vermont needs to be $21 in order to afford rent. That was brought out by a coalition of housing advocates talking about the how expensive it is to rent housing in Vermont and the need for more affordable housing. The other thing that came out was the cost of health care. Our exchange rates are some of the highest in the country in terms of what the Kaiser Foundation looked at in terms of other exchanges. And so that got me thinking, if you're on a fixed income and these prices keep rising, whether it's housing or healthcare in particular, because that is the area where you're going to feel it the most, and you don't get Social Security increases, which you don't, and healthcare costs keep going up, which they do, will you retire in Vermont or will you look for some other place that may be less expensive? You know, you can control your cost. You can't control usually your income. Once you're retired, you are on a fixed income. You know what that fixed income is going to be. Usually it's with Social Security, and you have some have supplemental income from an IRA account, an individual retirement account, or from a pension account from another source. So you know what your fixed income is going to be. You know what your income is going to be. The only thing that you can perhaps control, you can control your income by probably staying at work. But where you really can control your expenses, where you can really control your income, is reducing your expenses and making that income last longer. And if you look at other states, and national studies will back this up, that it's cheaper to live in other states, especially states that don't tax your retirement income, have lower property tax and housing and living costs. You know, you can, in some states, you can probably reduce your living expenses by as much as a third by moving to another state. But those aren't the other thing. There are other things as well that you need to think about when you're retiring. Weather. Maybe weather influences your decision of where you're retired. It isn't expenses that influences your decision. Maybe it's family or friends that influence your decision. And for some, maybe it's the social services network. May not be as robust in other states as it is here. Be very interested in your opinion and your comments. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I'm asking the question this morning, will you retire in Vermont or is Vermont too expensive for you to retire in? Give us a call. Or you can go onto our Facebook page and click on the new poll that we have that asks this question, will you retire in Vermont? It's a new way that we're trying to reach out to you to get your opinions. So give us a call, 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Will you retire in Vermont or is it too expensive to retire in Vermont? Let's go to Bill and Barry. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Of course, I would say yes because I did retire in Vermont and I have a very good reason to retire in Vermont and money is part of that reason. Now, I did retire as a state employee and I have the benefits as a state employee, and I have been with, I won't go anywhere else. It's not just because of family. My wife's family, a whole lot of them are here, but I have family in Florida. We have family out in Oregon and other places. I've lived in about six of the East Coast states, from Florida all the way up here, and I the weather may be the reason, the best reason. We do not have hurricanes. We do not have tornadoes. We have heat waves. We had a heat wave Monday. But the weather. I like the winter and the summer and up here the best. But it's the services. I will say this also. Yes, money is a factor. Money is a factor because to pick up from here and move is expensive. The move itself is prohibitive for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically it. Vermont, the people are good, too. I got to say, the people are good. I don't necessarily completely agree with all the politics, but when I retired, I spent a lot of time out at the State House, and I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the fact that you could go in and out of that State House and talk to everybody, including the governor and lieutenant governor. It's great for that.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you for your phone call. The question we're asking right out of the blocks today on Open Mic is, will you retire in Vermont, or is it just too expensive to retire? And as Bill had talked about, there are other factors that he considered, including family, people, friends, and the weather. He likes the Vermont weather. We also are introducing a new way you can communicate at Open Mic, and that's to go on to the WDEV Facebook page and decide to answer our poll question, which is today, will you retire in Vermont or is it too expensive? We've had a change here. It's a tie now between yes, no, and maybe in terms of what it was. That's a big swing because there was no votes. So we are looking at that poll. That's a way of deciding, giving us an indication of what your feeling is out there. And the reason we're looking at this morning, the reason we're talking about this, is some of the national studies out there indicate that Vermont is very expensive when compared to other states for retirees. It also, a couple of reports have come out just recently as well, where it said rental and housing is high, rental and housing is high cost here in Vermont, as well as health care is high cost. So that precipitated my question in terms of what do you think? Do you think it's too expensive for you to retire here in Vermont? And if you're retired, why did you stay here? Like Bill said, it was the weather, it was friends. You know, there are other factors as well, and I suspect that you will find that weather can switch both ways. You can go out to a better climate or stay here because you like this climate, or you can stay here. But it is an interesting question in terms of what you will do when you retire. Will you stay in Vermont? We're one of the oldest states in the nation. We're the second oldest state in the nation. So it's an interesting question. We don't have enough time to keep on to this subject. What we will do is keep this question up on our Facebook page. I'll tell you the results at the end of the program. Up next, Dr. Harry Chen. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Dr. Harry Chen, who's the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health. Good morning, Commissioner Chen.
Good morning, Mike. It's great to be here.
Commissioner, we've had a lot of discussion on the show about ticks and tick-borne diseases, and so I wanted to go right to the top here and talk about it with you. Recently, there's been a lot of questions about tick-borne diseases. It seems like the weather has helped sort of bring this out because there seems to be more concentration, more stories about ticks and tick-borne disease. What has the department been doing to get the word out?
Sure. Mike, I think you're absolutely right. We're concerned about tick-borne diseases in Vermont. There clearly is an association between diseases like Lyme disease and our warming climate over the past probably a couple decades. I mean, I remember when I first came to Vermont, the only Lyme disease came in a car from Connecticut. That's no longer the case, and, you know, Lyme disease is a significant public health issue here in Vermont. So, what we try to do, really, is put out public information messages about being tick smart, telling people about what they should do if they find a tick and how to identify the ticks. The protective things people can do, I think everyone agrees that if you can prevent tick-borne illness, that's the way to go. And it means changing how we, changing our culture, so to speak. So it's tick checks after you've been outside, outdoors. It's using that bath time with your kids to make sure they don't have any ticks on them. We have some evidence now that if you take a shower right away, you can actually prevent the nymphs that may be on you from actually attaching to you. And then additionally, there's some evidence that if you put your clothes in a dryer, a hot dryer, for 10 to 15 minutes right after you come inside, you can actually prevent, you can actually kill the ticks. And then there's all the insect repellents, the DEET and the permethrins that are appropriate precautions people can take when they're outside getting their, getting their exercise and their sun.
One of the things that I'm curious about is that we hear about Lyme disease a lot. Are there other diseases that are associated with ticks?
Absolutely. And most of the diseases in Vermont come from what we'll call the black-legged tick, which used to be called the deer tick, and we're actually trying to change that name because it's more than just deer that serve as a reservoir. So it's mice, it's rodents, and even some birds that may do so. But there are other diseases that are actually increasing in prevalence. One of them is called anaplasma. Another one is called babesiosis. These are things that physicians need to check for when they're checking for other tick-borne diseases.
And what do you look for when you're taking a bath or taking a shower? What do you look for in terms of a tick bite or a tick?
Well, ticks to cause disease have to attach to you for at least probably 36 hours. And so you're really looking for a small insect. The nymph stage is what we'd be seeing right now, and they're most active and most likely to transmit disease. And nymphs are probably a little bit larger than a poppy seed, so they're really not very big. So you got to, you got to look pretty carefully. And then in the fall, when there's a second peak of Lyme disease and ticks, they tend to be the larger adults, and they're probably the size of a pencil eraser. But I think appropriately, if you see one, it would be attached to you and not just crawling on you. People should remove it. And if as long as it's not been there for 36 hours, the likelihood is really small that you get any disease from it. But it's certainly something you can consult with your health care provider about.
If you do get bit and it starts to get it's noticeable, and I gather it's a red mark. Is that right, Doctor?
Well, I think the thing to think about when you think about Lyme disease in Vermont is if you get a flu-like illness in the summer when you don't expect to get the flu, fever, muscle aches, chills, and then you have a rash or maybe some swollen joint pains with it, that's when you have to start thinking about Lyme disease. Whether you see a tick or not, or whether you see the rash or not, that's something we're trying to clue in providers that to have a really high index about treating Lyme disease and treating it clinically early and sufficiently.
And once you get the disease, what do you do? Let's suppose you get bit, you get the disease. What do you do then?
Well, Lyme disease in general is imminently treatable. So if you make the diagnosis, and as I said, most of it's based on clinically, if there's a history of a tick bite, that's helpful. If you have a rash, that's characteristic. That's also very helpful. And you can actually treat it with 14 to 21 days of a pretty common antibiotic. And most people do just fine with that. Sometimes people need to be treated a second time, and sometimes people need to be treated for a little longer. But usually that's with disease that has been perhaps missed. Because there was no history of a tick bite or there was no clear-cut rash, and then you may need longer courses of antibiotics.
There are some advocates out there that believe that more should be done, more physician training, follow a different standard, follow the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society guidelines, educate kids in school, And more links on the subject on your website. Is that something you're looking at, or where are we with those sort of
things?
Well,
I think we have discussions about that all the time, and as you know, there's no shortage of sometimes of controversy surrounding these issues, and so importantly for me is to find those areas we can have agreement on, which is trying to, you know, we're underwriters on BPR. We have a video contest for high school students about Lyme disease every year. We actually have a educational curriculum, but as you might imagine, the school day is pretty jam-packed, and it's hard to get schools to actually use it. So, you know, as we all know, we really prize local control in Vermont, but that makes it challenging to ensure that every kid gets exposed to that. We're actually making a contact with this organization called Four Winds that does most of the environmental learning with students in Vermont, and we're hopeful that they'll include it in their curriculum. But, you know, we try to get it out everywhere. You know, I almost every year write a piece for the Green Mountain Club. We get it in the Green Up Day materials. We get it in the kind of the hunters and the, you know, outdoor folks reading material. So we do our best to get it out there. There's no, you know, there's no Lyme disease, you know, funding per se, although we're trying to get some from the CDC. We're doing the best with what we have.
We're speaking with Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Dr. Chen, we have some calls that are lined up, but I just want to ask one question before we go to the calls. You mentioned about deer ticks or the new name of the tick, but can we get these diseases from our domestic pets as well?
Well, the answer to that is probably not. It's not transmissible from an animal to a human or a human to human. It has to have a tick in between, I suppose. I'm not sure if animals would be classified as reservoirs like mice and deer, and I don't know that per se, but I really don't think. I think the major reservoir are wild animals, but certainly dogs can get Lyme disease and can get symptoms and can get antibiotics for treatment also.
Let's go to the phone line. Let's go to Pat in Essex Junction. Pat, you're on open mic. Good morning. Pat? Well, we don't have Pat, so we'll keep going here. Pat, if you call back in, we'll try to get you on. You talked about preventing some of the disease. Well, John, I'm going to go back to the phone lines here. Let's go to Rachel in Hinesburg. Rachel, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Hi, Harry Chen. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Rachel.
I'm calling in, and first of all, I want to say thank you so much, Harry, for admitting this morning that sometimes people need more treatment than what doctors have been saying is the standard course. What I'm calling about is all this new great research that's going on, and I want to make people aware that Harvard University, MIT, the Institute for Open Medicine have been sponsoring a Lyme hackathon all over the country, and what they're trying to do is focus attention on what is going on with Lyme disease, and they're doing it because there just isn't enough research to support the stance of to fully support the stances of either the Infectious Disease Society or the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. And so they're trying to inspire all these different researchers from around the country to get in there and come up with great ideas, and then they're funding the winners of this Lyme hackathon. And I also want to point out that there are universities all over the country right now, respectable universities, that are admitting that the tests are not reliable, that we need more reliable testing. They're admitting that there may, out of Johns Hopkins, we have a researcher who found a new way to test live spirochetes versus dead pieces of spirochetes. and he is saying that he does believe it is a persistent infection. And I just think what we really need behind all of this is research and answers and open-mindedness on both parts so we can solve this. And Harry Chen admitting that sometimes people needing longer-term courses of antibiotics is a step in the right direction.
Thank you, Rachel, for the phone call. Harry, do you want to respond to that?
Clearly everyone would agree that we don't have all the answers. And research is and science is really the basis for new discovery and changing our practice. And so we're all open to that. I think that we need to be cautious about how we approach that research and look at it critically as we do with all research. But you know, we need to have that research behind us to really distinguish if it is an ongoing infection. And up to now, that evidence hasn't been clear. I think we need to understand that people have symptoms that are longer term that are related to a Lyme infection, but how to treat them best and how to take care of them really is something we need to do better at, and we need to have that as oftentimes needs to be that conversation between a provider, a doctor, and a patient.
Is this disease, whether Lyme disease or other tick-borne diseases, are they often misdiagnosed?
Well, I think that there certainly is. Evidence of misdiagnosis. I don't know that we really know how many times they are, and I think that's one of the challenges. I think in some of my discussions I have with people who are very interested in the disease, I've asked the question, well, how do we know how well physicians are diagnosing it? And so I'm thinking about how we do that, whether it be a survey, whether, you know, in terms of trying to engage physicians. But in general, most of the time the diagnosis is not hard to make, but you have to think about it. We do provide continuing medical education training to physicians, and we do present all sides of the issue for them. Because I think, again, importantly, as a physician or another healthcare provider, you look at the evidence and you look at your patient and you make that decision with both their best interests in mind and a kind of mutual discussion in terms of shared decision making.
We've got Pat from Essex Junction back on the line. Pat, you're on open mic with Commissioner Harry Chen.
Hi, Dr. Chen. Thank you for being on this talk show. I think it's great for listeners. This is an important subject in Vermont. It is an epidemic. And I have heard so many stories from people that have been misdiagnosed. And my concern is that the doctors, and I'm not saying they're doing this on purpose or to continue to not diagnose people because on purpose, but I really feel that there is overall a lack of training in Lyme disease. It seems to me that there are many people coming in with tick bites and they're being brushed off as being spider bites. I heard one story that a medical professional told a patient that once they're bit, they're immune to getting any kind of Lyme disease in the future. There, I've heard a couple of stories. Just recently, I was at a picnic in Stowe, and somebody had two tick bites. They went in to their doctor, and their doctor gave them two pills. And two pills for a possible Lyme disease case, that's not a treatment for anything. I mean, anybody, even if you don't know anything about medicine, two pills for any kind of treatment, it just seems like false security. So I hear these just misdiagnoses. People are walking away, and they might occur, 30 days later or 2 months later, they might start feeling sick, and they don't connect, 30 days back to, oh, I was bit by a tick, because it's out of their mind, and they can't, the regular person, general layperson can't make that connection between, oh, I was bit 30 days ago, and now I have a flu. So my concern is that people are going to go misdiagnosed, and eventually their health will take a downward spiral, And then the loss of productivity, often people have to stop working, they go on disability. It's costing the state a lot of money.
Well, let me ask this, Pat, to Harry Chen. How do we prevent misdiagnoses?
Well, I think a lot of it's education. A lot of it's educating both providers and, frankly, educating the public to have ask those important questions. And there's no question. I mean, you know, the challenge is there are a lot of stories, and there's no doubt that these are stories that people are relating. We don't know, you know, obviously you don't know the full picture related to a story, and so to the extent that we have to look at what the research shows us. But there's no question that educating physicians is important, and educating the public. That's how you have to do it. I think, you know, one of the challenges is with Lyme disease is that if you ask experts, get a room full of experts, half of them might say a person did have Lyme disease, and half of them might say they don't. Mm-hmm. And so, again, as an individual, there's no question that an individual does have symptoms and is suffering. The real question is it Lyme disease and is it treatable by another or longer-term courses of antibiotics? And that's the challenging issue that physicians have to deal with every day.
I'm curious, just out of one of the questions that Pat raised from hearing somebody talk about it, can you be immune from Lyme disease once you get it?
It does not cause immunity getting it. You can have recurrent Lyme disease, and that's certainly one of the one of the best studies out of the New England Journal actually looks at people that have long-term symptoms, and a significant portion actually have recurrent disease, meaning they got another tick bite and they got Lyme disease again. Now, there was a vaccine out about 10 years ago. It didn't do well in terms of side effects. Certainly a vaccine is one of the answers, and they're actually developing one now as we speak, although it may be a couple of years out.
It's curious that I think we have a vaccine. What I read this morning when I was doing the research, Commissioner, was that we have a vaccine for dogs, but we don't have a vaccine for humans. Is it more difficult to develop a vaccine for humans?
Well, as you might expect, the process and the rigor and the cost related to developing a vaccine for humans would be significantly higher and more stringent. I remember taking my animals into the vet, and basically you just treat everything, and you know that would be sufficient. But in a human, that might not be sufficient.
I am doing the research this morning, and we're speaking with Dr. Harry Chen, who's the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health, and we're talking about ticks and tick-borne diseases. And I was getting confused this morning when I was reading. There are different sort of testing or guidelines that physicians use in order to determine whether somebody has Lyme disease. And I'm getting confused between the ELISA testing and the ILAD testing. And ILAD is an acronym for, if I remember, I don't even remember what the acronym is, but let me find it here.
International Lyme Disease Society.
Right. What's all this mean?
Well, the traditional tests are done and looking for your body's reaction to the Lyme infection, the Borrelia infection transmitted by the tick. And early in the disease, it is not a good test at all, meaning, you know, that a significant portion of people, so I don't even recommend getting the blood test. If you have the rash and you have the fever and you have a history history of a tick bite, don't even bother with the test. Just treat the person. And that's really the best way to go clinically. Later on in the disease, it is a pretty good test, and meaning it will pick up 95% of the cases. Now, there are other tests that are being done or being touted as being better. Frankly, the problem with lab tests is they need to be carefully validated, and it's a long process in looking at people with the disease, looking at people without the disease, to really come down to that, how reliable are these tests? And many of those tests actually haven't been validated. People are using them, and that's really where the gray area comes from, well, in terms of whether a person really does or doesn't have Lyme disease. So we need more work there in terms of validating some of these tests. But right now we have a pretty good set of tests under the right conditions, although there's no shortage of controversy about that.
One of the things that I've noticed, people who do have Lyme disease and have it over a long period of time, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible disease in terms of what it does to your activity level, what it does to your energy level. What can be done when you're in the midst of that? Because I think it probably brings the onset of depression and everything else that goes with the ability of being immobile, doesn't it?
Right. And Mike, you're absolutely right. These are the, so just to, you know, kind of level set, if it's diagnosed early, it's treated appropriately with, you know, 14 to 21 days of antibiotics, the vast majority of people just do fine and they get better. So that you're looking at 80% of people. There's a subset of people, that 20% of people that actually have continued symptoms, there's no question these are real and sometimes disabling symptoms. The question, and they need to be treated in terms of whether it be ancillary medicines, anything else. But the question really is whether there's ongoing infection and antibiotics continue to help them. But I think there's a lot of that's where the controversy is, frankly. But again, there's no question that people are having these symptoms, and that they need to be treated with whatever is available that actually helps them get better, which most people thankfully do.
One of the things that I noticed this morning as I was looking at these issues is that the legislature passed H-123. What does that legislation do?
Well, what are the concerns that individuals who obviously are very mindful of Lyme disease and the toll in terms of what happens with people with chronic symptoms in Vermont, is they were concerned by physicians not prescribing long-term antibiotics because they were worried about them losing their license. And so what the bill really says is it told the Medical Practice Board to create a policy where stating that they would not sanction physicians solely on the base of long-term Lyme treatment.
Okay. I'm going to take some phone calls. John, before I break, I'm going to if I can take these two phone calls, and then we'll break, and we'll come back with we're speaking with Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health. John from Tunbridge. John, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I have just one question. I know the ticks live in long grass. I have quite a bit of that around my house. Is there a product that I can use to kill them? I mean, I know about DEET and all that. I put that on, but every once in a while I'll have one slip by. I usually catch them, but...
That's an excellent question. Is there a way of reducing your exposure to ticks by, you know, pesticides?
Yeah, you know, there's been some work in that, and it's not particularly satisfying. So they actually have tried using, you know, standard pesticides to reduce the tick population, but at least the studies to date have not demonstrated that that works. I think... there are some, what I'd say, kind of environmental things you might consider, which is, you know, if there's areas of really where you spend a lot of time that have that long grass, certainly cutting it short would be one of the ways to reducing the likelihood of getting that tick, the ticks on you. But trying to control it otherwise really has not been fruitful.
Let's go to Bill in Waitsfield. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi. Morning, Mike and Dr. Chen. I'm looking at an article that... with regard to Lyme, and it's by Dr. Daniel Cameron, who's a specialist in Lyme disease from New York. Anyway, it's a recent article that Chris Christopherson, who incidentally recently turned 80, I think this week, has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and he was recently found to have Lyme disease. And has been responding quite well to the treatment. So just thought I'd put that out as a, you know, piece of information that a lot of times winds up being diagnosed as something else.
Thank you for your phone call. We've talked about misdiagnosis. What's the research? This will be my last question, Dr. Chen. What's the research out there in terms of providing a vaccine for this?
Well, in terms of, you know, there was one in development, and so as it does, you know, continue through it, the process, once it gets developed, certainly a vaccine would be a wonderful way to deal with this on a kind of population level. And so I think, I think most people would welcome that. I think the challenge is, you know, would it have to be every year? And as you might expect, would it have side effects associated with that? But just to Bill's point, there are there are delayed symptoms related to Lyme disease if it's not diagnosed, and clearly having that in the back of the mind as a clinician, whether it be changes in terms of cognition, whether it be arthritis, whether it actually be damage to your heart. I mean, those are all things that you can see on a long term, you know, with a Lyme disease that's kind of been dormant and not recognized initially.
Dr. Chen, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Great. Great to be here. Thanks.
We've been speaking with Dr. Harry Chen, Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health, and we've been talking about ticks and tick-borne disease. When we come back, I'll update you on the poll results that talks about will you retire in Vermont, or is Vermont too expensive to retire in? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're introducing a new feature today, which we hope will continue on every day on Open Mic. And that new feature is if you go to the WDEV's Facebook page, you can vote online on the question of the day. And the question today is, will you retire in Vermont, or is Vermont too expensive? Right now, I'll give you the poll results. Yes, 27%, no, 45%, and maybe 27%. And the reason we're asking that poll question today is that I've heard many people talk about when they retire, they're looking at various things in terms of what they need to do in retirement. One of them is control their expenses. And as they look, they realize that in other states, they don't have to pay income taxes for their retirement money. Their property taxes are lower. Their housing and living costs are lower. Their medical expenses may be lower. Perhaps as much as they can save, perhaps as much as a third. So my question is, will you retire in Vermont, or is Vermont too expensive? Or are there other issues where you may say, yes, I'm going to retire in Vermont. I have relatives here. I like the weather here. That baffles me, but I like the weather here in the winter. So, you know, will you retire in Vermont? Go to our Facebook page and vote how you feel. Yes, no, or maybe. Again, let me just update this right now and see where we are. We're still at 27% yes, 45% no, and 27% maybe. I want to get to a couple of quick issues before we get to the network in 3 minutes. Just in D.C., House Democrats have staged a sit-in that's making a lot of news. We have Representative Welch, Sanders, and Senator Sanders and Leahy being at the center of that news. They're protesting a lack of a vote on gun control in the House. And it seems, I don't think anybody is winning on this. It seems that it only reinforces the perception of chaos in D.C. And despite where you fall on the gun control issue, and that's what they're protesting, is a lack of gun control in the House. Despite where you fall on the gun control issue, it really, I don't think anybody is coming out ahead on this. It looks like high school. And I would think those up for re-election would be concerned of the message this sends, because it looks chaotic. It looks like a system out of control. And it feeds right into the mantra that I think we got to be worried about, that the political system is broken, that this is just more proof that the political system is broken, that that people can't work together in D.C. And I think it hurts the Democrats as much as it hurts the Republicans. It's just as negative on both of them for these things. I think most Americans, most Vermonters, think it's perhaps childish. It's high school antics. And it reinforces that our political system is a mess. And no wonder the American public wants more outsiders to be elected. Coming up in the second half of the program, we'll speak with Ann Galloway from Vermont Digger. And what we want, what I want to get into, and it's sort of a continuation of the discussion we had yesterday, was how news will be delivered in the future. And then I want to have a discussion, a really frank discussion, about Donald Trump. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be back in a moment. Is that me, Artie? This is Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I didn't expect that intro coming in, so thank you very much. We're introducing a new concept today. It's a daily poll question, and today's poll question is, will you retire in Vermont, or is it too expensive? Right now, you can go on to our WDEV's Facebook page and click on either yes, no, or maybe. And right now, let me give you the poll results. 38% say yes, 38% say no, they're not retiring in Vermont, and 23% say maybe. So it's very close out there in terms of, will you retire in Vermont, or is it too expensive? As a couple of callers have said, there are other results. There are other things that you look at when you are retiring other than expenses, family, weather, those sort of social service network, in terms of your ability to get the same social services elsewhere that you would get here. So if you have an opinion, go on our WDEV Facebook page and click on either yes, no, or maybe, will you retire in Vermont, or is it too expensive? Well, welcome back, and we'll turn our attention now to national news. And on the line is our colleague, Victoria Jones. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning. Well, as we speak, Representative Peter Welch is on C-SPAN via Periscope, I believe it is, speaking illegally, of course. Well, not illegally, but against the rules, against the House rules, as part of the ongoing sit-in.
Yeah,
your congressman is talking now.
And what I find fascinating, Victoria, and I'd be very curious about your opinion, because I'm going to get to the Britain vote in a minute, because I'm really curious about that. But it seems to me that wherever you fall on the gun issue, whether you're for more gun control or not for more gun control, I got to tell you, from just looking at it on TV, doesn't it sort of bring this perception that there's chaos in D.C. and doesn't it bring this perception that this is a political system that's broken, and it looks a little bit like high school? What's your take on this?
Yeah, it looks like they've taken over the high school theater.
Yeah, and I don't care what your view is on in terms of what they're discussing, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, I just think it looks like chaos. And I would think that it just feeds into this perception that Washington's out of control.
Well, I think it does. And it feeds into the perception that Washington's broken. And I think many people, you know, for many people, Washington is broken. And I've had conservative hosts say to me on the air this morning, just give them a vote, you know, just let them have a vote.
Yeah, like the Senate did, just give them a vote and maybe all this goes away. I guess I'm frustrated with all the tactics, all the politics, all the crap that's going on in D.C. So let's turn to Britain and what's going to happen?
Well, I mean, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and they've got another 7 hours of voting over there. They vote until 10 o'clock tonight. And so it's not easy to say, and I'm not sure that they're doing exit polls. So I don't think we're going to know. They've got paper ballots. Very simple question. Do you wish to remain in the European Union, you know, UK, or do you wish the UK to leave the European Union? It's not the kind of question that you can actually get wrong. You know, sometimes when we have referendum questions, it's so complicated, I end up not answering the referendum question because I don't even understand the question. But this one, it's difficult to get wrong. They will count the paper ballots by hand, and then we'll probably get the results by breakfast their time tomorrow. So it's a breakfast Brexit, if you like. What's going to happen? Well, the bookmakers and the markets think that financial markets think that they'll probably vote to stay in, is what they're thinking. But it's anybody's guess. The Remain, that's staying in, has had the momentum ever since lawmaker Joe Cox was murdered last week.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, Leave was having the momentum over the immigration issue, which is a very emotional issue. But with the murder of Joe Cox by a man who shouted Britain first and was, you know, seems like he was clearly a racist by all the things I've read about him from the Southern Poverty Law Center, it's shifted. But the polls are so tight. But then British political polls are notoriously unreliable.
One of the things I tried to bone up on this morning, just so knowing that you were coming on. And one of the things that I sort of noticed, if you're for staying in the EU, most of the arguments are economic that they're talking about. And if you want to leave the EU, there is a feeling that they're not in control of their own destiny, in control of their own future. Probably not in control of their own immigration policy, which is upsetting a lot of people over there. Am I characterizing that right?
Yes, I think so. I do think so. But, you know, if you leave the EU, you're not going to be in control of your own destiny very much, because you're going to become so insignificant on the world stage. But, yeah, you can control your own destiny, but you might as well be the Falkland Islands for the amount that you're going to matter to other countries.
One of the things I was looking at is that France, UK, and Germany are the big bananas in the UK. I mean, you look at what their GDP is in accordance with everybody else, and everybody else is, you know, Italy is a little bit up there, but everybody else is pretty much insignificant compared to those big three. One of the things I think that, to bring it to the United States, one of the worries that the United States would have, I would assume, is that if this starts breaking apart, that's our largest trading partner in the world is the EU. And if you look at public opinion polls in Europe, you can see that France is heavily favored of leaving the EU. Germany is about 50-50. UK is about, you know, 50. Well, actually, it's about
44, roughly.
Yeah.
Possibly.
So I'm wondering if Britain does leave, does this mean that the EU breaks up?
Well, there's talk about it. France is would be the next one. Let's talk about it. And that would be just desperate. I mean, it would just be desperate. NATO's, I think it was the Secretary General yesterday, was warning that Vladimir Putin is licking his chops at the prospect of Britain leaving the European Union, at how it would weaken NATO,
mm-hmm.
how it would weaken Europe, and strengthen his position.
So let me ask you this question, a political question. Does Cameron, Prime Minister Cameron, if he loses, he's gone. I get that. But if he wins...
He doesn't think so. He thinks he can survive.
Do you think so?
No.
So let me... So obviously he thinks if he wins, even if it's a squeaker, he survives as well, right?
He thinks he does, but, you know, I'm not sure that he survives if he wins. Maybe he does, but the miscalculation of having this vote is going to haunt him. He chose this vote. He didn't have to have it.
And, yeah, and I was just wondering, yeah, he brought this on himself by bringing the referendum up, but I don't know. So no prediction here other than the bookies seem to have things right usually, right?
Bookies are usually right. It's usually where the money is, and it's usually what people think is going to happen, and people think that the vote's going to go a certain way, rather than how they say they're going to vote, and people think that the vote will go for Remain.
Victoria Jones, as always, it's great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
That's Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Up next, Ann Galloway from Vermont Digger. And the topic we're going to talk about is how news will be delivered in the future. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. Joining us now is Ann Galloway from VermontDigger.org. And we're extending a conversation that we started yesterday when we spoke with Rob Mitchell, who was explaining some of the reasons why they were reducing, the Rutland Herald and Times Argus were reducing their print edition from 7 days a week down to 4 days a week, with 3 days a week being in a digital edition. And one of the things that I thought of is, let's talk to Ann Galloway, whose publication is completely digital. And good morning, Ann. How are you?
Good morning, Mike. I'm well.
You know, Ann, where is the print media heading from your perspective? And is it in your direction, all digital?
I think that that's probably inevitable over time, just because it's very expensive to print, and it's very, very expensive to deliver print newspapers, and more people are using using the internet to get their news, and so it is all shifting in that direction, and it's really no fault of the newspapers. It's just the way our world is going.
You know, we had Rob Mitchell on yesterday, and he was very candid, and I appreciate the fact that he was very candid, talking about the business model and how expensive it is in terms of printing and delivering a printed newspaper. So I understand the business decision on the print side, but is the business model of the digital side, does that have obstacles as well?
Oh, yes, there are some major obstacles, the biggest of which is that most of the revenue that newspapers are able to pull in come from the print side. And so to make the transition to online is, I think, really difficult. And from what I read, they want to get 50% of their revenue from online advertising within a very short period of time. And I do think that that is going to be a difficult thing to achieve. In our case, for example, about 40-50% of our revenue comes from underwriting, which is the nonprofit version of advertising. And the rest of our money comes from donations and from grants from foundations. And so I, one of the reasons why I went nonprofit as an online news organization is because no one has really figured out how to recover advertising dollars online. And part of that has to do with the landscape that we find ourselves in. Most of the advertising now is with Google and Facebook and Twitter. And so the local market really has nowhere to go with it because those ginormous companies have been selling advertising at a very, very, very low rate, pennies on the dollar. And local advertising has always been a little bit more expensive, but it's also more targeted. And because online advertising now, even in national publications, can be targeted to local audiences, it just changes everything. And it's much more difficult online than it is in print. And so I wish them luck. I think it is going to be hard.
But you raised something that's really interesting in that the big internet companies, the big powerhouses, Google and Facebook and those powerhouses, do go after local advertising nowadays in terms of ad placement within various digital landing sites for people. How do you compete against that?
Well, I mean, I think, again, it's really about the product really trying to explain to advertisers that what we do is important for the local market and that we have, in our case, we have a pretty avid audience of people who are interested in politics and public policy, and now we're expanding into geographic areas. So, you know, people who want to follow what's happening in municipal government in Burlington, or if they want to keep tabs on the decommissioning process at Vermont Yankee and Windham County, you know, we're the go-to source for that kind of information. But, you know, that's the pitch we make, is that we're reaching local and statewide audiences that Google can't really reach in a very targeted way. I mean, it's for us, it's more than just general demographics. You know, when you're on Facebook, you can choose different groups of people who might be interested in your content. You can choose age groups and whether or not someone's interested in politics or news in general. But with our product, because it's so, it goes so deep in certain topic areas. I mean, I think they're, you know, advertisers get that, and that's why they buy in. We try to give them good value. You know, we provide people with access to our daily email. In addition to ads on the site, we're doing more events with sponsors. And we're always trying to come up with creative ways, you know, to involve people in supporting us. You know, a lot of local advertising firms have also gone to events instead of traditional advertising. So that's, I think, hurt newspapers some. It's a tricky business. It really is.
And does the nonprofit model pose a risk? Because you're always fundraising, aren't you, for this?
No, not always. I mean, yes, but no. I mean, we have a donate page that is present on our site all the time, but we only have two fundraising campaigns a year. We just finished one. We raised $150,000 over about a 5 to 6 week period, and well, I guess it was 5 weeks. And then we'll do one at the end of the year. But we try to limit it as much as possible because we know it's annoying. On the other hand, only about 1% of the total number of readers who come to our site in a month, and that's 200,000 people, only about 1% actually contribute to VT Digger. And the news is free on our site, and we did that for a reason. We want Google to pick us up. We want readers to try us out and see if they like us. And so we'd never charge for content like a lot of newspapers do. But we do rely on donations from people who appreciate our work.
As technology changes, and it seems to change rapidly, almost daily, does the platform change in how you deliver the news? Is that, does technology change changing cause you to have to constantly change as well?
I wouldn't say that they're radical changes in the way we're operating. You know, we've had a website since 2009. I think we'll always have a website, you know. So that's the platform, and it's really just about how you deliver the news and how you, you pull people in. So, for example, we've made investments in search engine optimization. We hired an auditing firm to help us understand how we could better, you know, produce keywords on the back end that, that Google picks up on the Internet. And so, you know, it, that, that helped us a lot. We were able to pull in more readers. You know, we're always experimenting with social media, but I wouldn't say that we're fundamentally having to change the way we deliver news on a daily basis as a result. We're producing more content, so more of our content is ending up in Google News as a result. And, you know, we have an email subscription service, and we've had that from the beginning. That's not going to change. Ironically, that's sort of the dinosaur delivery method on the web, but it's the most effective one. And we have more than, you know, 10,000 subscribers now. So it's really, you know, there are fundamentals that we've developed from the beginning, and we're going to stick with those, and I don't expect that to radically change.
Is the way that a reporter reports changing?
Well, I think that... you know, I take a really old-fashioned approach to journalism. You may know that I have an investigative bent, and so what that means is that I expect our reporters to have a document state of mind. And what that means is that in addition to listening to what people have to say, we also want memos and lawsuits and other documentation that helps us understand what's really happening behind the scenes. And so that's, you know, traditional journalism. And then we do a lot of shoe leather work. We talk to our sources all the time. We rely on tips from readers. All that stuff is just basic. The thing that's changed is the 24/7 news hole and the way we deal with that. And but that, too, has a kind of foundation in traditional approaches to journalism. The Associated Press has always had a write-through approach to stories. In other words, something's breaking. Say, for example, a month ago, we had a story about Burlington College folding. And we had badgered Carol Moore about the NEASC process and didn't get anywhere. But lo and behold, after the graduation, we got a press release. So we posted a story based on information that we got out of the press release. We updated that story about four or five times during the day as new information became available. I updated it about an hour after that first post to provide people with context with all the historical information that we've been gathering for 2 years, because this is a... We investigated problems, financial problems with Burlington College over a two-year period. Then later in the day, Elizabeth went to a press conference, and she added material from the press conference. Later, I had an opportunity to talk to Tom Torti and another source, and so I added that material to the story. So by 7 or 8 o'clock, we had a, I can't remember, 1,500-word story, I think, you know. It was a really, and that would be in 7 days or in the Times Argus, a really long story in print. You know, that's many columns. I've forgotten the conversion rate for words and column inches, but it would have taken up a lot of space in a newspaper. But because we're online, we have the advantage of not having to buy ink by the barrel. We can put limitless pixels out there. Our limiting factor really is our audience and what they're willing to read. And my philosophy is that we should be updating as new information is made available on the web. And we should write stories as long as they need to be. And readers can always stop reading.
I'm interested in the sort of the influence that Twitter or Instagram is having on news. How do you integrate those social media platforms with news operations?
We do have a pretty avid Twitter following. It's climbing all the time, but we have more than 15,000 Twitter followers. We have someone on staff who is scheduling VT Digger posts on Twitter. And then our reporters interact with readers, and they post their own stories. But we don't use Instagram. I've made a few bets, and our bets are on Twitter and Facebook. We don't have limitless capacity for social media. So I think it's important, and we need to be doing it, and we need to be interacting with our readers. But we also have a very active comment section on our site, and that takes a lot of time. And that's where we have more of a direct connection with our readers than we do in social media. So we have a slightly different approach there. That isn't to say we ignore Facebook and Twitter. We don't. We were out there, but we also have this commenting platform that's very active.
And I'm curious, but just bear with me for a moment, because the other day I was taking a flight and I noticed I looked up from my tablet and realized that everybody else was glued to a tablet. And wondered about this in terms of how we communicate with people and where we get our information. We have access to the whole world. We can communicate to the whole world. We can get information from the whole world. And yet, it seems like we're in our own bubble. And I'm wondering, philosophically, do you sort of look at where you need to be in order to keep up with what people are doing out there?
That's an interesting question. I would say yes and no. I mean, we're not faddish in our news coverage. You know, our news organization is really dedicated to some people call it accountability journalism. You know, we're really focused on the role government and business play in our society. And so we pay attention to what other news organizations are doing, but we don't always write the same stories that everyone else is writing. And that's because at the end of the day, we're more interested in making sure that readers get the information that they need to participate in our democratic process here in Vermont. And that means covering the legislature in a thorough way, so that if people want to respond to new legislation or oversight hearings, they can. They can be involved. I'm not so worried about. We don't do celebrity news, for example. We're really, we have our heads down and we're focused on ferreting out information that people don't have already. You know, news is what somebody somewhere wants to cover up, and the rest is advertising. That's straight from Lord Nordcliffe. And, that's my belief, that there's a lot of stuff out there that people don't necessarily want us to know about, and that's news.
Ann Galloway, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Ann Galloway from Vermont Digger talking about the future of delivering the news. And just an update, we started a new feature this morning at WDEV at Open Mic by putting a poll question up. And the poll question today is, will you retire in Vermont, or is Vermont too expensive? You can go to our Facebook page, our WDEV Facebook page, and you can click yes, you plan on retiring in Vermont, no, you don't, or maybe. Right now, it is close. It's 41% yes, 41% no, and 18% maybe. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In this segment, I want to have a frank discussion with you about Donald Trump. And it's going to be frank. I mean, it's been a dismal month for Donald Trump's presidential aspirations. And the political prospects of the party who he's going to secure its nomination. And it's all on him. I mean, first, Trump gets sidetracked with these controversial issues that are of his own making. He picks a fight with a judge that rules against him in a court case involving fraud charges against Trump University. And to this day, I don't understand why he did that. And he picks a fight with a very popular governor, Governor Susana Martinez, who doesn't support him. He later decides to weigh in on the Orlando nightclub shooting, which, by the way, is appropriate for a presidential candidate, but he utters a string of confusing statements that undermine his leadership credentials and undermines his support of from the National Rifle Association, by the way. In addition, just a few days ago, it was revealed that Trump's fundraising efforts, they've been dismal. They've been atrocious. They've been awful. And although he claims he can self-fund a presidential campaign, he's also expecting money from Republicans. That help so far isn't coming because he's yet to demonstrate the ability to expand his coalition, much less be presidential. And believe me, this is a big deal. You may not think it's a big deal because he's a billionaire, and you can say Trump's a billionaire, he can fund his own campaign, but it's through the fundraising capability of the party's presidential candidate that the state-by-state field operations that help other candidates is largely made up, and that's making a lot of people nervous. Without those funds, everybody suffers. It's every Republican suffers, not only Trump. And then we find out at the beginning of the week that he fires his campaign manager, who was the architect of the sort of policy, the strategy of let Trump be Trump, with the explanation that the campaign goes in a different direction. Well, yeah, it does have to go in a different direction with the disapproval rates of 70% in recent polls. You know, there's no doubt that his campaign needs to go in a different direction, and fast. But what does that really mean, going in a different direction? Does it mean that Trump will no longer be Trump? And if he isn't Trump, just who is he? Donald Trump has yet to articulate a consistent set of core beliefs or values. And I'll tell you, if he doesn't do that, people will continue to struggle with the question of what he truly believes in. And his opponents will relish this because it will easily, without defining who he is, they will define him. And they will define him in the light that they want to define him. And that's already started, by the way. And conservatives, he's got a problem with moderates in his party. He's got a problem with conservatives in his party. I mean, his conservatives aren't convinced he's a conservative. He's never expressed a single conservative value before this presidential campaign. And he even said a couple of times that he was a Democrat. And moderates or centrist Republicans see him as dangerous, that a candidate that is lacking empathy for those that struggle and has these isolationist tendencies that jeopardize the breadth and depth of the Republican coalition. The truth is, no one really knows who Donald Trump is, what he believes in, or the positions that he will have on issues from day to day. But luckily for Donald Trump, even with those political hindrances, he is still relatively close to Hillary Clinton in some national polls, although he's starting to lose some ground to her. This should worry Democrats. They should be really worried about this because Donald Trump had perhaps one of the most horrible months that anybody could have, and yet he's still fairly close to Hillary Clinton. And in fact, Hillary Clinton is at a disapproval rate of about 55%. And although that's better than Trump, this has to be a major concern for the campaign. Donald Trump is squandering precious time in this campaign. Time where he needs to define himself, define his opponents, coalesce the Republican coalition, appeal to independents, and raise a ton of money. He needs to be a disciplined candidate with a disciplined campaign. And right now, you're looking at both, and they're not disciplined. Perhaps being undisciplined is what we meant when we said, let Donald Trump be Donald Trump. And if that's the case, he will never be a good candidate. He will never be a good president. It takes discipline to be a good candidate. It takes discipline to be a good president. It's time now for Donald Trump to make a decision. He needs to either step up or step out. If he can't demonstrate his capacity to be respectful, a competitive candidate, and a capable president in the weeks ahead, he should step out and let the convention delegates nominate somebody else. Somebody that will run a credible campaign. Otherwise, he's going to bury the Republican Party. And the question that I have is, does he care? So step up or step out for Donald Trump. Got a little bit of time for phone calls. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Hey, listen, Donald Trump has already defined himself. He's a narcissistic bully wannabe. That's who he is. That's what his campaign is about. And because of this, he's attracted this this wide group of overt racists. Now, I understand everybody who supports Trump is not a racist. However, he has attracted the overt racist to his side, and it's a large contingent of the Donald Trump following out there. He's already defined himself, and quite frankly, if this collapses the Republican Party, especially, I'll say on the national level, good. Let's not forget, this is the party that wanted to bring us Sarah Palin as vice president back in 2008. Donald Trump is just a natural extension of Sarah Palin. He's just appealing to the worst attributes in people, and he just draws his issues straight off the internet from whatever blog he happens across that gives him some wild theory that he wants to go out and run with. This is Donald Trump. He's defined himself. He doesn't need defining. All that needs to be happening by Hillary Clinton and people speaking for her campaign is to get out there and just continuously reinforcing the conception that Donald Trump himself has created.
Hey, thanks, Rama, for your phone call. And in fact, in the Wall Street Journal today, there are prominent Republican businessmen that are business people, because I think there's women in there as well, that are coming out in support of Donald Trump. These are Republicans who have supported Republican presidential candidates from years past and now are coming out to support Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump's opponent. So, you know, this is going to be changed around really fast, or this is going to be a blowout. So it is interesting, to me at least, what Donald Trump is going to do. Is he going to step up or is he going to step out? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We got about 90 seconds already to take a phone call at least. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, this is going to have to be a quick one.
Hey, Mike. Yeah, I'm not going to defend Donald Trump on everything, and nor would I defend Hillary Clinton, but I think A.G. Lynch saying the most effective response to terror. Did you hear this?
Well, tell me about it.
Unity and love. Is that a strategy?
I don't think it's a strategy. It's sort of a feeling. What we have to do, I think, is a strategy for ISIS is figure out a strategy that will defeat them militarily and then figure out a strategy of what we're going to do in the Middle East to make sure that another ISIS-type organization doesn't rise up. And that means getting in there and figuring out why people are so impoverished in an area where there is a difference between the rich and the poor.
Am I still on, Mike?
You are.
Okay, well, I mean, you say it's not a strategy, but she says our most effective, I'm quoting, our most effective response to terror is compassion. Compassion for who, Mike? What does she mean?
Well, I hope she's not meaning ISIS. That's
okay.
Not that's
so
not a...
Maybe she needs to clarify that. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a response to terror, okay? And unity, how do we unify with terrorists, Mike? And with love. Are we going to love the terrorists?
Well, I think...
Effective response to terrorism, I'm assuming. Terrorist, right, Mike?
Well, I don't know the context that she's talking about. I think, Rob, we're probably mixing a couple of things up in terms of what she's talking about. Maybe she's mixing things up. If you want to defeat terrorism and ISIS is your target, you got to defeat them militarily. I think that's the only way to start the process. If she is talking about what we need to do as a country to come together, I agree with her. We need to come together as a country. We need to develop a strategy that we can all agree on. So, Rob, thank you for your phone call. I really appreciate it. We've got a new segment for Open Mic, and that is you can go to our WDEV Facebook page, and we will have a poll question each day. And today's poll question is, will you retire in Vermont? And right now, that poll question is tied. Yes, 41%, no, 41%, and maybe at 18%. And the reason we've been asking that poll question is because many listeners complain how expensive it is in this state. And by the way, national studies sort of back that up in terms of how expensive it is to be in this state compared to other states who do not tax retirement income, who do not tax, where property taxes are lower, and some other aspects. But a couple of you have said, well, that's not the only consideration. Weather is the consideration. Friends and relatives are a consideration. So if you want to go on to the poll, we'll leave it open for the rest of the day before we change it. And will you retire in Vermont? Yes, no, or maybe. I want to thank our guest, Harry Chen, Commissioner of Vermont Department of Health, Ann Galloway from Vermont Digger. Tomorrow, Chris Cole, Secretary of Transportation, will talk about the Montpelier-Barrie Road redesign and how it is creating controversy. And then Nora Jacobson, filmmaker and winner of the 2016 Herb Lockwood Prize for documentaries. And it'll be interesting. We'll talk about her prize and her art. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 from Warren, 96.5 from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond, and of course, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls. Have a great rest of the day, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.